This is episode 5 of Extraordinary Women Radio. Welcome to Extraordinary Women Radio. I am your host, Cami Gilner. Women are being called to live with voice, vitality, and vigor. Each month, join me for wisdom-filled interviews with extraordinary women living out loud and making a difference in our world. Their stories will uplift, inspire, and spark your own purpose-driven journey. Wow, I'm so excited and honored to be interviewing a real powerhouse, trailblazing woman today, Dr. Jacqueline R. Henningsen. I love to meet women who have made a lifetime of writing their dreams. And Dr. Henningsen, who is in her 70s, has had one heck of a ride when it comes to writing your dreams, and she's certainly not done yet. Jackie passionately believes that age is not a restrictor, class is not a restrictor, and gender is not a restrictor. Jackie's had an extraordinary career path to share with us today that has taken her from a teacher at a public school to top-ranking positions in the U.S. government. She is a retired member of the Senior Executive Service and currently is an independent consultant and advisor in the areas of professional and educational development, applied analytics, risk management, and STEM opportunities. She retired from the U.S. Air Force in 2014, where she was responsible to the Secretary and Chief of Staff. Over the course of her career, she has served 6 United States Air Force Chief of Staffs as the principal advisor and leader of Air Force Decision Support Analysis. Jackie focused on helping senior leadership fireproof their decisions with a solid analytic body of work grounded in scientific fundamentals. Her expertise and knowledge lent quality to a span of areas ranging from nuclear deterrence, joint war fighting assessment, to risk management. As a civilian, she has achieved the equivalent to a 3-star general, and over the course of her career, she received 2 Department of Defense Distinguished Civilian Service Awards in 2001 and 2009. She also received the Meritorious Executive Rank Award in 2005 and was recognized with the Presidential Distinguished Executive Rank Award in 2012. So talk about a trailblazing woman doing epic things in her life. I'm so honored to have you on Extraordinary Women Radio today, Jackie. Welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's great to have you. So when we first met, you shared with me a poem that had been given to you as a young girl. And I'm going to share a bit of that poem with our Extraordinary Women Radio audience because I think it has a particularly important message. One day, through the primeval wood, a calf walked home, as good calves should, but made a trail all bent askew, a crooked trail is all calves do. Since then, 300 years have fled, and I infer the calf is dead, but still he left behind his trail, and thereby hangs my moral tale. Now, I'm not going to read you this full poem by Sam Walter Foss. The story unfolds over the course of 3,000 years where dogs and sheep and horses and man follow the course of this crooked trail. And eventually, the poem ends with this last section. One day, 100,000 route followed the zigzag calf about, and o'er his crooked journey went the traffic of a continent. 100,000 men were led by one calf near 3 centuries dead. They followed still his crooked way and lost 100 years a day. For men are prone to go it blind along the calf's path of the mind and work away from sun to sun to do what other men have done. They follow in the beaten track and out and in and forth and back and still their devious course pursue to keep the path that others do. They keep the path a sacred groove along which all their lives they move. But how the wise old wood gods laugh who saw the first primeval calf. Ah, many things this tale might teach, but I am not ordained to preach. Jackie, I love this poem. Yeah, isn't it awesome? Yeah. So tell us why this has stayed with you for so many years. How did this shape some of these important choices of your life? Tell us the story behind it.
You know, the really interesting thing about when coming across this poem was it matched something that I've done my whole life. I took a class, and it was a Saturday class, and it had absolutely nothing to do with my major. When I was in an undergraduate school, and it was an art for young children class. And I had heard that this instructor was wonderful. And I just, you know, love anybody where there's somebody that's wonderful. You know, you've got to go see what's wonderful about him.
Right.
And so one Saturday morning, I took this class, and that's what he started the class with. And then he showed us how much he could learn about young children by watching the stage of their artistic pictures. You know, how did they draw their family? Who was holding hands? It was very psychological. And I was very interested in psychology and ended up with an undergraduate minor in psychology as well. So when he read that poem, it just went, oh my gosh, that just says so much. And through the years, it has stayed with me, this idea that people really, unless they carefully think about what they're doing, they will tend to just follow the easy path.
Right.
And when I came across things that seemed a little different or that might lead a different way, I really consciously struck out to take those paths and look for what was a groove and what was a journey. And so this really is something that has inspired me my whole life.
Right. And you think about when I look at your journey, which I was from the very moment we met, I felt like your journey was just so inspiring. You started out as a teacher. You found your way into those top executive offices of the U.S. government. So you certainly had to take some really different paths along the way to make some different choices, route your own trail in a way that was just not following everyone else.
Mm-hmm. And some of it, and as I'll talk about a little later, it's not always conscious. I call it pulling threads. It's kind of like you look up at the sky or the universe or whatever it may be, and you'll see a thread hanging there, and you give it a little light tug to see, you know, what is that? And just like going to a class with somebody that I don't know anything about, that little light tug connects you. It kind of hooks you, and you kind of follow that little path and look around at where it may take you and find that it's a whole different place than you expected to be, but equally inspiring and wonderful if you just, you know, take that step and pull that thread.
And how do you know that that's a thread to follow? Is it intuition? I mean, what's inside of you that says, you know, that's a thread that I'm interested in?
You know, I think that part of it is that it resonates with my passions.
Okay.
And my passions are about, you know, the logical thinking, the analytic thinking, but they also are about adventure, reaching out, finding new things and new ways to use my personal talents. And so when something resonates that way, and then the other thing that, as I'll tell many people that I'm advising or giving career advice, there really isn't a wrong thread to pull unless it's illegal or immoral.
Right.
And the really thing is that once you pull it lightly and it kind of hooks you, then it's a matter of living or taking it or embracing it passionately. So there is no menial job. There is no time that what you do doesn't have the potential to reveal something very amazing to you. Even in the smallest things, you can find extraordinary, you know, linkages. You know, just calling you this summer, last summer, turned out to be a wonderful serendipitous thing.
Right.
And I called you. We didn't end up being able to get together, but the link was, oh, here's a woman who is leading a very passionate life, and it's based around her love and understanding of horses. I love that. I want to meet this woman. And it was like a little thread that we pulled. And I ended up in the other part of the state, so we never met. But we've developed a relationship and a friendship through the common interests that came because I just pulled this little thread.
Oh, I love that. And I love that. I love the way people come into each other's lives. And if we're just open to being curious, open to wanting to know a little bit more, and the experiences I just always find that people come into each other's lives for reasons, and always believe that there's no accidental meeting. So I love that.
I completely agree with you. There is kind of a saying about you have friends of the road and friends of the heart. And there is an implication that the friends of the heart, who are the enduring long-time relationships, are so much more important, as though you can lower the value of the friends of the road. But I look at it differently. The friends of the road are the spice, the seasoning, the developing factors in your life. And they are the ones, and you've heard this from Buddhist mythology background, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear.
Right.
I couldn't believe that more.
Right.
At every point of my life, at a time when I needed someone to inspire me, to guide me, to caution me, they appeared. I didn't always know that they were appearing, but they did. And some became friends of the heart, long-time relationships, and some of them were there just briefly, like the art teacher.
Right.
Who has touched me my whole life, and I knew him for one morning.
Right. And this the poem has carried forward for you for all those years. So that's fantastic. And it's the universe just certainly provides for us in whatever unique ways that we need. So I believe that so much as well. So tell me a little bit about what it was like as a woman breaking through the ceiling to a top executive office in the Pentagon. I mean, that just had to be an incredible journey. Tell us about that journey.
So we went to Omaha to a larger school system, one of the top school systems in Nebraska. And again, same pattern, doing more, but I began to notice the women were not young women students. We're dropping out, as my classes were all equal sized.
Mm-hmm.
I taught an Algebra 1 class or a geometry class.
But they weren't carrying forward the women.
Dropping
part.
Out. And by calculus, there was maybe one or two women in the whole class.
Interesting. And, what do you think that is?
It really was a lot about society, the expectation. Don't worry your pretty little head about this math stuff. You don't need that. I was never any good at math. I don't expect my daughter to be any good at math. Messages, signals. The thing that I found that was completely surprising as I began to touch on it, though, was it wasn't as though the young men were better at math or even loved it more. It was that they saw it as part of their journey. And that they had a recognition of needing a certain level of capability in something to go on and do what they really wanted to do.
Right.
And so they kind of took on the pain and didn't judge themselves with it. The young women, if they didn't get A's in their classes, they dropped out. They used it. They personally judged themselves.
Saying,
I'm not good at this. I've got to get out of here.
Yeah.
It wasn't even at that point I'm ruining my grade point average. It was I'm uncomfortable, therefore I won't do it.
Okay.
And
you got passionate about changing that, didn't you?
I absolutely did. And so starting up another path along the way, I started a Title IV program that worked on math anxiety. And it happened to connect at the particular time in the country with a lot of that. That's the mid-70s. Interest in math anxiety, what it was doing for preventing women to going into non-traditional careers. And so I linked with a national network, and our work, fed into that. I began to attend a lot of conferences. And this is like a turning point. What I did beyond just the program and working and talking and put together presentations that I put on radio and that type of thing. I also wanted to demonstrate what I meant to the students. And so I said, I can take the curriculum from a college and I can take any class in this curriculum because I've got math and science. And they kind of like, you can do what? I said, yeah, I'm going to sign up for, two classes this semester. I think I'll take, I think one year I took statics and dynamics. Mm-hmm. Which was, the physics and that arena. And so I was doing that, and then I took a course in optimization, which is a area of mathematics that at that time was in our particular University of Nebraska system was under the industrial engineering program. It's also in business and others. And I took that class, and it was like, ding, this is what I want. This is what I am really passionate about. This is what I've been tracking all these years. How do you optimize whatever you're working on? How do you get more out of scarce resources? How do you minimize risk? Those things all resonated with me. And so I already had a master's in math education. The University of Nebraska asked me to work because of my work with women to, they offered me the opportunity to get a PhD while I taught there and worked on the, let's see, it was the University President's Council on Women for the University of Nebraska. And I accepted. So I had to take a little pay cut, actually, from teaching, high school teaching. Mm-hmm. But I got this wonderful opportunity. I got to go back to school. I was teaching three classes and taking three classes each semester and driving 100 miles a day. And so it was a little pain, a little stress. I had to put myself out, but it was a wonderful thread to pull.
And so you started doing some really critical problem solving analysis there that you mm-hmm. were eventually able to be doing in the U.S. Air Force, where you're solving very big problems for our nation.
Mm-hmm. It fit together. It was like, again, I had no idea what path I was on. It wasn't like I've got this goal. Which I don't have anything, there's nothing wrong with people having goals and saying I want to become a lawyer and going for it. But I certainly didn't have that. I just loved learning. I was enthralled with the idea that I got to work on this degree towards this area that I loved, which is called operations research, by the way. And I began to meet people, these friends of the road, friends of the heart, in my classes that were from Strategic Air Command in Omaha. Mm-hmm. And they were taking night courses, and some of my courses were at night, and so I met them. And so I'm rolling along here, never really thinking about the fact that some point this program is going to end. I'm going to have my PhD. And then the question is, oh, okay, so now do you go back and become a high school teacher again, or what do you do?
Right.
And there was not a real, I was living in the moment very much. But at one point along the way, I worked with a woman. Her name is Paula Wells. Paula is, she and her husband have raised or adopted over a dozen children, some special needs children, but she's an industrial engineer. They have their own company in Omaha. And I worked for her part-time, kind of got the sense of, okay, what does that job look like? And I went to get a summer intern as Strategic Air Command, again, never expecting to do anything except get a chance to try out my new skills. The man who hired me, who's still a dear friend at Strategic Air Command, told me when I said, I don't even know, anything about airplanes or military or any of that stuff.
Right. Said, so you're stepping into a role where you don't know some, you don't know the details, right?
Right. And definitely still a very male-dominated
career. Right, absolutely.
So, but he said, hey, look, you're not marrying the job. You're just taking the job and see how it goes. And maybe after the summer you don't want to do it.
That was that thread that you grabbed a hold of, right?
I grabbed it. I pulled it. I went.
And it stuck.
Oh, my gosh. You have wrapped a rope around my waist and just
whoosh, pulled you up into
pulled
it.
Me up.
Oh, that's awesome. That is so awesome. And so, when you think about that journey as you stepped up into it, it must have been that you just kept working through the problems, grabbing those threads, working more problems, and people seeing your brilliance that you were bringing mm-hmm. to the table that raised you up. Is that true?
Well, it was kind of a partnership type of thing. It's like I knew this area well. I mean, the operations research area I knew well, and I knew how to apply it. They had problems that they didn't have solutions to or ways to address. They did have an OR department, so there was people that were of that mindset. So they started me out working on problems that others had worked on.
Right.
But very quickly, I began to just look around, pulling the threads again, and I will call it wander around the building, and talking to people, found that there were all kinds of problems and all kinds of areas that could use the application of optimization and this logical work that I knew how to bring technically to the problem. And so it started with very straightforward things where I would partner with an expert, a military expert, and myself. And one of the early problems was the fact that the Air Force had had a series of accidents with aircraft accidents. And although there had been boards that had determined what the cause was, the chief of staff of the commander in chief of the Strategic Air Command was not comfortable that they really understood what was going on. And me, with my psychological background, my operations research background, I'd had a lot of work doing surveys and that technical aspects of building surveys. He asked for a different, deeper look. And I happened to be the one that got the call and partnered with some experts in the aircraft. And we developed a way of looking at the question that dug a lot deeper into what were some of the underlying causes. We actually, in the end, there was many things going on, but one of the things we were able to change was the difference between the charts that were being used, or you might call them the maps, that were being used by the pilots and by the navigators. There was actually, it seems incredible now, but they were using different maps for reasons that were seemingly appropriate, but were, you know, the devil on communication. And so that whole thing came out of a lot of travel around the country, talking to young flyers. It was this wonderful opportunity to, you say, travel the world and talk to people.
And you were a woman in a very male-dominated industry, I'm assuming.
Very much. And, you know, I still tell people, don't assume that you don't have to dress for the job. You know, some people want to fight that. And I guess if you're in the fashion industry, you know, fight all you want. But if you're aspiring to be a professional, then don't let what people expect to see get in the way of your ability to deliver. So if they expect to see a professional person dress like a professional person, show that you understand the job that you're aspiring to or that you're in. Right. And so I started out with gray suits and floppy ties.
Right. Oh, I so remember those. And I back in the day, my old corporate days, the things that I wore. And you know what? It's interesting. I think that there's actually a shift happening. I think that there's that women can't, that, you know, trailblazers like you were, you had to show up in a really, you know, strong, almost masculine presence in situations like that. Mm-hmm. Is that true?
Yeah, you didn't have to. Now, I never went to the route of, okay, I have to be a yelling, screaming, or any of those type of stereotypes. Mm-hmm. But I always, but again, I said, don't let me get in my own way.
Right.
So
right.
How I look should not get in the way of what I can do.
Right.
There's only so much you can do about how you look. I mean, you can, as women, we've got lots of opportunities to do makeup and haircuts and all of those kind of things. but you don't want those things to become a distraction.
Right, right.
You know, one of the stories I love is that my mother-in-law, a lovely lady, was so upset because she wanted me to have a red suit, and she couldn't understand why I couldn't wear a red suit to work. And she said, you know, you've got this red suit, you're lovely in it, why don't you wear it to work? And so when I finally, I'll call it, got over the barrier into the executive level, by then times were changing, but also I developed a persona. A persona that I was passionate about analysis, and the way that I was going to tell people that is that they would see me in red. And so 20 years later, I was able to develop the expectation that although professional, they would see me in red. And so bless her, I think about her every time I wear a red suit or a red anything, because
I love that.
The young folks call me the lady in red.
Oh, that's fantastic. And so what I love about that is that, yes, you know, in those early, early days, it didn't feel, I mean, it would have been a really hard thing for you to have shown up with. But over the course of your career, you got to this place of just being comfortable in your own skin. And it's like, and yes, I can wear red while I'm doing this.
I think
that's the shift. And I think it's you know, I'm very thankful for trailblazers like you that did that early work. So that today women can really step up and be who they are as a leader and let their leadership style, not style, but leadership, who they are as a leader really shine through them authentically. And I think because of the beautiful work that, you know, women have done over the course of our lives, it's shifting and changing. And I think there's lots of open space for it, but I love your rich suit. That's fantastic.
Yeah. It's been very interesting because if I'm at a conference and I'm talking to a whole room full of people, I'll say, and I'm wearing red because, and then they'll come back, because you're passionate about analysis. And the crowd all knows it.
Oh, that's fantastic. So that's become part of who you are.
It's my persona, right? Yeah. It's who I am.
Yeah.
And
would you say that it's who you are at your very core? I mean, like inside out, that the red suit really fits you.
Right. Yeah. And I wouldn't turn around and say, okay, you're a GS 11 or 9 and you should develop come in and say, I'm doing this. At that point, again, don't get in your own way.
Right. Right. So tell me about a defining time or situation that forever shaped your life.
I had been with the Strategic Air Command for 6 years when they had a major reorganization of the Air Force in the whole nation. And the Strategic Air Command in Omaha was changed to a command that was not just the Air Force. It was completely reorganized. You hear a lot about government reorganization. This was a major government reorganization. I was a GS 15 at the time. I had been promoted very, very quickly. Of course, I already had, 20 years of teaching and leadership in different areas behind me. But you still had to come into the government at the lowest rung that you qualified for in terms of your education. So with a PhD, I came in at a GS 9, went to 11, 12, 13, 14 and 15 very quickly. So by 1991, this still is astonishing to me to think about. I was the most senior woman in the Strategic Air Command. Mm-hmm. Strategic Air Command at the time had 150,000 people.
Wow.
We were starting to get more and more women, military women as well. But at that point, I was the highest ranking woman in 150,000 member command with 6 years of experience in that area. It was a lot of timing and then a lot of attention to detail and working with people on the problems that they were trying to solve. But what happened was the reorganization got rid of all the jobs that were GS 15s, mm-hmm. got rid of all of the senior executive jobs, which I would have been beginning to aspire to at that point in Omaha. at the Strategic Air Command, and we were put under what's known as a reduction in force, a RIF. And so I was, at this point, my husband's teaching full-time, has been for over 25 years, is well into his career. But there is no job for me in Omaha at the level that I am at. I could have taken a reduction in grade, and that was a possibility. The job that I had was moved to Langley, Virginia, which, where's Langley? I mean, I certainly knew, but I'm just saying it was nothing on our radar scope.
Right.
And so I thought, you know, if I'm going to go on with this career, I need to go to the Pentagon. Okay. Because that's where kind of all roads
upward. All roads lead to the Pentagon, right?
Lead to the Pentagon, or cross through the Pentagon, at least. And I hadn't done that. I was at the time at a program for senior officials in national security at Harvard, at the John F. Kennedy School. It was one of the things that they sent us to as a development program. So I was rubbing elbows with people from all the services at the similar grade level I was. And I guess I should have known it, but I kind of was surprised to find that I was very comfortable with people from all the services, all experiences, military, civilian. I mean, I knew it from my own command, but this gave me a different look at it. And the academic part gave me a chance to sit back and kind of contemplate. And I decided I wanted to go forward, and that meant that choice. Now, this is a choice for my husband and I, not just myself.
Yeah.
And we talked about it a lot, and he has always been incredibly supportive. And he said, we can make this work.
Yeah.
And we ended up, he had a teaching contract. He stayed for another year in Omaha. But the nice part of it was then they gave him a sabbatical. So it was kind of like we had 2 year safety net.
Yeah.
Which sometimes is a nice thing to have when you're kind of uprooting your life.
Right, right.
Our son was already grown and married by this point. And
so there's your adventure to Virginia.
There's my new adventure.
Yeah. And so how did that feel when you're, you know, when you say, okay, I'm going for it. I'm really, you know, making this choice. How did that feel?
You know, it was a little bit of fear, but very exciting. You know, I was sitting, when I got ready to drive out the door, Carl had gone to work that morning. I got in my car. I'm sitting in front of our house that we had lived in for 25 years by that point. And I'm sitting there and I'm just thinking, I'm pulling out the door and we're selling this house. You know, 25 years is behind us now.
Right.
And I'm driving off into the sunset.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's kind of what it felt like.
And you know, what I love about that is the, you know, so it's so important for us to really realize that sometimes when we get these things, you know, the reduction in force, the RIF, which I, by the way, I despise the word reduction in force because it's so dehumanizing. There's nothing. And it's like, I think they choose RIF because it doesn't, you can't really picture the people associated with it.
Yeah.
I was part of a RIF several years ago when I left my corporate job to do, and where, you know, it led me down this journey to doing what I do today, when I'm, you know, which I'm on my, you know, my path of what I'm supposed to be doing. So sometimes those pivotal moments in our life where there's something comes down that seems really devastating at the time, because a RIF can seem very, very devastating. But what unfolded for you, and like my journey, was it took you to this whole new place, this whole new experience that you would have never gotten to had that not happened. Is that true?
You are so right. You know, it's to me, just as you were saying that, it's like a flower opening.
Yeah.
You've been sitting inside this flower bud, and I would have been safe and happy, and I probably would have got a little bored, and then, you know, at some point and started doing other stuff. So something would have happened with the job or something. But instead, it's like the flower opened up and there is this whole world out there, and it was a new world. And I'm in the Pentagon and I'm walking the halls and I'm got a portfolio of business that, I mean, you just, the thing that I went into was like quite amazing.
What does it feel like the very first day that you walked the halls of the Pentagon when you got there?
It was just overwhelmingly, you know, just like mouth open type of thing. And then they gave me my portfolio, and you can't believe this portfolio I got. My portfolio, because I've been a Strategic Air Command, was the space launch and strategic weapon systems portfolio in the cost analysis program. Now, I had not been a cost analyst before, but they said, well, you're an operations research analyst. You can figure it out. So,
here's the folders. Take them and just go figure this out and let us know what you think, right?
Yeah, and there's people around here who will help you, which there were. They were wonderful. But yeah. This is my portfolio. I've got to get it ready to present to the decision authority who's going to decide whether to let a program. One of the big programs I was working on was called the Titan IV missile. Titan IV missile is the missile that launches rockets into space. And the program was being costed for the out in the open for the first time. It had come out of the black world. And so I had to go trace all the money that had been spent. They had put a lot of money into it after the Challenger blew up.
Right.
And so because it was our only access to space. And so lots of money had gone in there, and they were now, okay, let's figure out what all this money was. And that's when I took over.
Okay.
It ended up, I had to make a cost estimate on the program. I had a team to work on different parts of it for me and with me. And we came up with it being a $37 billion program. That was our estimate.
Wow.
And the Air Force at the time said it was a $32 billion program. So now I've got to build the evidence and show why the Department of Defense should expect and ask for a $37 billion program. So trying to figure out where, you know, show them why it's $5 billion more. And this was my first introduction. This was my first portfolio in the Pentagon.
And when you think about standing in your power, asking, you know, for that extra $5 billion,
what was it
that in you that... what came through you? What were the leadership, the essence of you that came through that moment when you stood up and you were doing that ask? What was shining through you as a leader?
The knowledge that you have to be prepared to defend what you're saying, you can't just say something. You really have to have your facts, and they have to be right. When you're spending money like that and you're investing in technical issues like that, you really have to have your act together. Mm-hmm. And so I worked, I guess it was lucky that Carl was gone that first year, because I worked incredibly many times through the night, you know, just being sure that everything that we'd done, we had to go out to all the contractors. They had to explain their program in more detail than they'd ever explained. It's just part of the business, but I was learning so much. And I laugh sometimes. I tell the folks, you know, out in the courtyard of the Pentagon is an open area that's very beautiful with trees and bushes and things there, benches, and luckily, because I had a tree that was my favorite tree, and I used to commune with that tree when it got too rough.
Oh, that's fantastic, because you got out to nature, right? So what did that tree offer to you?
Just a little bit of solace, a little remembrance of, back when you were a kid, you used to sit in the tree-lined front yard, and it was very, very soothing, and you knew that all was going to be well. And now, okay, all is well. Now get back to work.
That's so important for all of us to find those places, those touchstones in our life,
right,
that we can really reground ourselves in those moments of difficulty, in those moments of, you know, I've got to really pull up my pants here and really, you know, be all that I can be, you know, that courageous you. And and having something like that, a touchstone like that tree, like that, you know, what it stood for you, you know, even taking you back to your childhood can be so powerful. So I love that, you know, just as, you know, I encourage our listeners to think about what's your touchstone, what is the place that fills you up, that, that gives you the strength that you need when you're going to go have those tough conversations. So thank you for sharing.
It's really very much so. You know, now I've kind of incorporated into a phraseology that I use for myself now, but back then I just kind of felt, but now I tell myself, you know, breathe in God, breathe out life. And I can say that a few times to myself and just calm whatever I'm thinking about and focus. It's calm and focus. That's what I need to do.
Yeah. Because if we get wrapped up into all the frazzled energy, it doesn't serve us. The more that we can find that grounded spot for us.
You know, one other thing I wanted to mention before we go on, you know, back when I was just still at the University of Nebraska and I was finishing my PhD, and there was another woman who was in the program with me, and she was in studying, her PhD was in a similar area, but she was to become later the head of the environmental program for Nebraska, for the state of Nebraska. But at the time, we were both just turning 38 to 40, you know, it was in that age bracket. Yeah. And I remember at one point she said to me, after, I don't know, something where a group of young women had, we were trying to encourage them to come into the program, and we were talking to them, and she looked at me and she said, "Jackie, we just need to face it. Our glory days are over." And another touchstone that has stayed with me, I thought, no, Anne, our glory days are not over. So maybe just, you know, working my way through that riff with a little bit of no, Anne.
Yeah, they're totally not over. And what you did after that point is so incredible. And now here you are, you're retiree in your 70s. And I know there's new things ahead of you, right?
Yes, there certainly are.
So what goals do you have ahead of yourself, ahead of you right now?
You know, one of the goals I have, and I have been working back and forth on it, but I'm having a little trouble because I'm so delighted with the time I have to read now. It's overwhelming me. I'm just read, 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 read. So the first year that after I retired, I read over 100 books. It was just like back to childhood.
That's fantastic.
It's wonderful. But one of the things I'm really interested in is how much like the societal impact on women about math anxiety back years ago that I was, you know, working on. Is there an ageism, societal pressure that says at this age, I can't learn like I used to. I can't pick up new technology. I can't think the same way. I'm going to do the gentle slide into the future.
Right. And you're not going for any gentle slide, are you?
No, I'm really not. Again, I've taken up some of my the folks that used to work with me and that I maintain linkages with are people that are work at areas like at DARPA and the defense agency that does a lot of the cutting edge work. And they have been sharing with me, not anything that anybody else can't look at, but some of the different techniques that we can look at to test our ability, even our young high school students' ability to think through problems, technical problems. And, you know, they've got all kinds of different competitions that are out there for young kids to see how attuned they are to cyber areas. And it's like little, you might call it little mathematical tests and things like that. So I've been playing with those. I've taken some of them to one of the undergraduate school programs that I'm working with and looked at, why don't we see how this particular program looks? And I'm really interested in, so how does it look if you have motivated seniors work in these areas? Through these, I'll call them the competitions of logical, technological thinking. Is there a decline? I'm finding the interesting part probably isn't in the decline. It's, again, about focus. I've got to commit myself to focus. And it isn't a focus that has to do with fuzziness. It's a focus of all the competing things that I'm inspired and want to do.
It's which one to choose, right?
Yes.
Right. So how are you choosing?
Well, I'm not choosing well for the cyber right now.
Okay.
I am really quite, as I've always been, very interested in, working with development of young people and people who are aspiring in areas where it takes their technical background, their STEM background. And so I find myself, if I've got the choice of me doing it, like working on a little technical area, coding or something like that, or me helping somebody else figure out how they can get into that area. Right now, I lean more towards the helping others get into that area. So I continue to work a lot with development of young folks in educational forums. And,
that's awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So what three pearls of wisdom, as we wrap up today, can you leave our audience with?
I think there are many that I could choose, but I just, as I was thinking about your question, I think it comes around the word believe. Mm. And the first one I'd say is believe in people, unless they've given you a lot of reason, not a little reason, a lot of reason to not believe in them. One of my friends told me once when I had, very unintentionally not returned a call or snubbed them or did something, walked past them when I was in a mental fog of trying to figure out something. And I, apologized. And they said, I chose not to take that personally. Mm-hmm. And I've written that down. That's important.
Right.
Not to take every slight personally. Know the people that, and know the realness of them. What have they always been to you? And then don't let little things
get in the way
of right. your belief.
And I think that's really important right now, because there's so much
ugliness.
I mean, there's so much controversy across our nation, and within families and all these different things. So believing in the people around us, mm-hmm. and don't get caught into the little details.
Yeah. Know who they really are and honor who they really are.
Okay. Beautiful.
Second one is, believe in yourself.
Mm.
The belief in yourself is about that reaction I had to Anne telling me our glory days are over. and my reaction was no, that's not what I feel.
Right.
And you need to believe in what you feel. You need to believe in the value of pulling threads.
There's so much power in that.
And I think the third one I'd say is believe in the power of love. Mm. I had a inspirational woman in my life many years ago, back in my first teaching assignment. She was a woman in town, in a very, very small town, who everybody knew. She was kind of, you might call her the wealthy widow on the hill. Can you imagine it from fiction or something like that?
Right, exactly.
Her name was Van Sant Brown. She was in her early 80s. And she just was someone that I could go when things got a little dicey and I didn't know the background of the town. Why is so-and-so, dislike so-and-so? And what's really going on here? And how do I deal with this? And every time I go to talk to her, she'd, I'd say, well, what should I do about this? And she'd say, just love them. She, at age 80, so you had one thing we were talking about earlier about what would you tell your 70-year-old self? Well, what will I tell my 80-year-old self? At 80, she drove from Missouri to New York to catch a flight with some friends to go to Amaramago. She said, because, this is the, whatever they do it every 5 years or 10 years. She said, I didn't know if I was going to be able to make the drive when I was 90. And I thought, this woman is an inspiration for my life.
Exactly.
always looking ahead, always believing in herself. I can do these things. And so at 80, I hope I'm going down where I'm going to go. And
going with your girlfriends.
And driving.
That's right. Driving there, going to meet your girlfriends and believing in the power of love.
Right.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Jackie. I so appreciate your time today and sharing your stories, sharing your wisdom. This is everything that Extraordinary Women Radio is about. So thank you for being with us and joining us today.
Well, thank you, Kimberly. It's been a real delight to get to know you. I definitely hope that you not only are a friend of the road, but a friend of the heart.
Absolutely. I like that so much. I hope so too. Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope you liked this episode of Extraordinary Women Radio. If you did, please share this podcast with your own special tribe of women and help spread the love, the dreams, and the inspiration. Are you thinking about making the next bold move in your life? I invite you to take the Your Next Bold Move quiz at CammieGellner.com to find out how you can jumpstart a passionate and meaningful next chapter. You may also enjoy my book, Fire Dancer, Your Spiral Journey to a Life of Passion and Purpose, which is available on Amazon. In Fire Dancer, you will become intimately connected to your heart's calling and build the courage and resiliency to ignite your what's next. I'd love to hear from you on any of my social media channels. I'm on both Facebook and Twitter, and the links are available on my website. Till next time, my friend, listen to your heart, follow your dreams, and be you.